Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. After a very rushed hearing process, Republicans are moving quickly to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. According to a recent poll, 52% of Americans say Republicans should wait until after the election to fill that seat. In his new book, Supreme Inequality, today's guest, Adam Cohen, says if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, the court will do even more damage to equality, democracy, and justice. He says over the last 50 years, the Supreme Court has not become just conservative, but extreme. Rulings have done little to protect the rights of the poor and the disadvantaged. Instead, they have protected the privileged and corporations. And many rulings have coincided with widening inequality in the U.S. Adam Cohen served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and as a senior writer for Time magazine. His latest book is called Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to ask you about a piece of news that was reported in the New York Times yesterday. According to their report, Mitch McConnell does not want a desperately needed stimulus deal before the election because he's afraid it'll get in the way of confirming Amy Coney Barrett. So as we know, so many people are struggling to make ends meet. The Democrats have been fighting for months to try to get another bill. According to this piece, McConnell says, sorry, we're not doing it because we want to confirm Barrett. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that makes perfect sense from their point of view. The Republicans have made it their mission for the last 50 years to control the Supreme Court. It's been one of the most important things on their agenda always. And they've done very well. They got a 5-4 majority. They blocked Merrick Garland. But the Amy Coney Barrett nomination is even a bigger deal because this would make a 6-3 conservative majority. They could last for, who knows, for decades. So this is really big for them. And I'm just surprised McConnell was so honest about what are clearly his priorities.
Right. Well, he apparently told four Republicans about this in private. And so the New York Times, I guess, you know, talked to those Republicans off the record. A lot more information is coming out about Amy Coney Barrett. We didn't really learn that much about her in the hearings because she refused to ask so many questions. What really strikes you the most based on what you've read about her?
Well, a few things. One is the degree to which she really is a creation of the right wing, right? This is not someone who, you know, they didn't just look around the nation to see, oh, who would be a good judge to appoint. This is someone who she was really groomed from her early days at Notre Dame Law School, which has a very conservative bent. She's, you know, hooked up with, Antonin Scalia, gets a clerkship with him. He continues to groom her. She goes into private practice back to Notre Dame, and she's on everyone's radar, you know, from the beginning as this is someone who would be a perfect far-right nominee to the court. And she's 48 years old, so she'll be there for a very long time. So it's really the degree to which, you know, she is a creation is, you know, one thing that struck me. The other, of course, was her incredibly evasive performance before the Senate, where senators were asking very reasonable questions that would have gotten to just how extreme a candidate she is. And she really dodged, almost a bullet.
Let's talk about just a couple of issues that have come up in the past couple of days, because as you have said, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, the court will do even more damage to the ideals of equality, democracy, and justice. And I just want to read from an AP piece. Amy Coney Barrett served for nearly 3 years on the board of private Christian schools that effectively barred admission to children of same-sex parents and made it plain that openly gay and lesbian teachers were not welcome in the classroom. The policies that discriminated against LGBTQ people and their children were in place for years at Trinity schools, both before Barrett joined the board in 2015 and during the time she served. I can't even imagine what same-sex parents are thinking right now after reading this, and gay and lesbian teachers.
Absolutely. And I think it's such an important, you know, news item because, you know, conservatives often like to say, you know, we're not bigoted. We don't really have, you know, such different views about things, but we just believe in a different idea of the law and the role of the courts. We don't think courts should be activists. We don't think courts should interpret constitutional provisions broadly. And that's why maybe we don't think the court should rule in favor of same-sex marriage because we just don't think the court should get into that. But here we see that something very different. As you say, she appears to have been very involved with an organization that was actively practicing bigotry. And that's a very different thing. And, you know, I think everyone in America is entitled to know that she does not support these bigoted views, but we really don't know that. And she's going to get on the court anyway.
I also want to ask you about climate justice and climate change legislation, because we know that this will eventually probably end up in the Supreme Court. The Chicago Sun-Times has a commentary called Climate Change Answer Disqualifies Barrett for the Supreme Court. She replied that climate change is a very contentious matter of public debate. What are your thoughts about how she answered that question?
Well, I think it was terrible. And, you know, it's not contentious. You know, one commentator said it's like asking someone if they believe in gravity. I mean, the very clear, you know, broad consensus of scientists is that, you know, we are having a very deleterious impact on the climate. She refused to say that. And if you look at her biography, her father was a lawyer for Shell Oil. She grew up in, I think, very energy friendly environment in Louisiana. And that was a great example of how she evaded a question that the American public had a right to know what she thought about that. And her non-answer said a lot. And people don't realize the degree to which the Supreme Court actually plays a very large role in environmental policy. And particularly if she gets on the court and begins changing some of the law, of the rulings that have allowed air pollutants to be counted as under the Clean Air Act, that have allowed states to sue when the federal government does things that are bad for the environment. There are a lot of rulings that the court has made that have actually been very important in the fight against climate change that she could undo. So it's very significant that she said that.
It's very significant. Vox has a piece about this, and they ask, would Coney Barrett vote to overturn Massachusetts versus EPA, the court's 2007 landmark holding that the EPA may regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act? Would she vote to uphold the Trump administration's rescission of the Obama-era greenhouse gas standards for the power sector and its fuel efficiency standards for cars? I mean, there's so many questions here. And based on what we heard last week, we have no idea how she would rule in these cases.
That's right. And Vox is exactly right about that, because, you know, what a lot of people also don't understand is the degree to which right now, to the degree that we are doing things about the environment, it's being done by regulatory agencies like the EPA. They're the ones that are really going out there and trying to stop corporations from doing some of the worst damage. The right wing on the court, and it does look like Amy Coney Barrett intends to very much join it, is very skeptical of the role of administrative agencies and wants them not to have much power. If they don't have much power in the environmental area, it will free up corporations to pollute much, much more. So the stakes are very high here.
Adam, you come at this from an interesting perspective because you were a lawyer for the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama, and the ACLU in New York, Alabama, and Connecticut. And you write that you grew up in the afterglow of the Warren Court, which we'll talk about. You went to law school and became a public interest lawyer in large part because of its idealistic vision of the law. Before we talk about why you left the law, you know exactly what is involved in writing legislation. So how, okay, let's say Biden wins and the Democrats get the Senate and the House. I mean, that's the only way that we are going to get much needed climate change legislation. How should they write legislation to ensure that it does not eventually get overturned by the Supreme Court?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, the answer really is that they can't, because if you have five votes on the Supreme Court, you can strike down just about anything. And you know, I think that, you know, they should try to write the statutes as carefully as they can, looking at previous rulings of the court. But I think that if there were a 6-3 conservative majority, they wouldn't be bound by previous precedents. If they want to do something like strike down the Affordable Care Act, they will. And if they want to strike down an environmental law, they will, which is why it's so important, you know, it would have been important to keep her off the court. I'm not sure that that's possible. But another topic we may get into is there's more talk among Democrats about court expansion, sometimes called court packing. And that may be the most important important tool in the Democrats' toolbox, because by threatening to expand the court, by threatening to put more liberals on the court if the conservative court really is out of control and striking down statutes, that may be the best check on them. It might be the best thing to say to the conservatives, we've got an eye on you, and if you start striking down our important laws, we're going to add new members to the court. So in a way, I think that tactic may be more important than literally how a law is written.
Interesting. So the court would be 6-3 if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed. Let's say, for example, that Biden wins and he adds three more justices to the court. What would happen if a Republican then wins 4 years later and adds another three justices? When does that stop?
Well, a couple of things. One is it would take more than that, because presumably, you know, if Biden has done that, it's probably because Democrats have taken the Senate back. So Republicans would have to win the White House and win the Senate and the House, which I think it's going to be very hard for Republicans to do for a long time. So I don't see the Republicans being able to do that for a long time, getting control of both houses of Congress and the presidency. But I agree with you. My instincts have always been skeptical of court packing, because I don't like the idea of turning the Supreme Court even into an even more political body where it's just who's able to put more justices on it. But with the way the Republicans have acted on, you know, Merrick Garland and Amy Coney Barrett, and with the extreme level of conservative people they're putting on the court, I think that to an extent they're really forcing the Democrats' hands and making this a much more reasonable idea, court expansion, than it was just a couple years ago.
With a 6-3 conservative court, can you talk about the importance of also bringing in the federal appeals court to these conversations? Because Trump has appointed more federal appeals court judges to date than any recent president at the same point in their presidency. And we know that so many of these judges are very extreme, and in some cases, according to attorneys, they're just not qualified, but these are lifetime appointments.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I was just reminded of that earlier today when I was looking at the Seventh Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals that Amy Coney Barrett is coming from. And I was sort of shocked to see that there really are only two Democratic appointees on that rather large court right now. That's how far Trump has been able to push these courts to the right. And as you say, it's critically important because, you know, the Supreme Court actually takes very few cases in a year. I mean, very, very few. Almost all of the actual, you know, lawmaking by courts is done by the courts of appeals and very often the federal district court, the lowest level courts. And if those are being packed by conservative Republicans, which they are, that's where most decisions will be made. And these cases won't even make it to the Supreme Court. And, you know, that the impact is monumental. And it's not only the things we read about, the, you know, terrible rulings where they, you know, do things that upset folks, where they strike down campaign finance laws and, you know, other things like that, but it's all the cases they reject, all the very reasonable, you know, employment discrimination lawsuits brought by people who really were discriminated against by their employers, who just, these cases don't get anywhere because they come before a Trump judge who has no interest in them. So there's a lot of damage, as you say, being done at the lower levels of the judiciary that we're not even focusing on when we think about the Supreme Court.
Right. How do you think Amy Barrett's confirmation will affect the cases the Supreme Court decides to take? Because that's also really interesting. We always get breaking news alerts about the Supreme Court either taking a case or refusing to take a case.
Yes, great question. So, you know, it only takes four justices to accept a case, five to decide it. But there's a strategy to that, right? Justices are always kind of gaming, you know, what happens if we take this case and how are we likely to rule and will this advance the, you know, my ideological position or the way I view the law? If they have six members of a conservative majority, first of all, they'll have a lot of control over which cases get taken because they only need four and they'll have six. But also, they will no doubt be a lot bolder in the kind of cases that they take. Because if you're in a very controversial area, you know, abortion or gun control, if you're a conservative on the court, you may not know exactly how that case is going to come out. You know, maybe Chief Justice Roberts, who has been a bit of a swing justice on the court and has sometimes voted with liberals, maybe we're going to lose his vote and we'll end up by taking this case, getting a real liberal ruling that might be reason not to take the court, but take the case. But when conservatives have six of the nine seats on the court, I think they'll be much more bold about taking cases that will push the law to the right, because they'll know that it's very unlikely they'll lose. Even if they lose Roberts' vote, they'll still have five votes. So I think they'll be much more aggressive about taking very ideological cases.
Today, we are speaking with Adam Cohen, who served as member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. He also was a public interest lawyer, so he really has a good grasp of these issues, as you're hearing. He's out with an important new book, Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. And if you have any questions or comments for Adam, the vote is going to start next week, and the New York Times reports that Mitch McConnell said no relief bill because he's concerned that it would get in the way of confirming Amy Coney Barrett. So they want her on the court as fast as possible before the election, which is in just 13 days now. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. I also wanted to ask you about Social Security and Medicare. We know that, 10,000 people turn 65 every day in this country. And so many people rely on Social Security and Medicare. And she did not say whether she believes Social Security and Medicare are constitutional. Senator Feinstein asked her if she agreed with originalists who have written to argue that those two programs are unconstitutional. And Barrett said, quote, "I can't answer the question in the abstract." What are your thoughts on this? And what could the Supreme Court do around Social Security and Medicare?
It's very frightening. You know, there is a conservative view that has been around for quite a while of what they call the pre-1937 Constitution. So in the 1930s, you know, when FDR was elected during the Great Depression, we got a lot of very big laws passed, including Social Security, that were designed to help ordinary people in very trying economic times. The Supreme Court started out striking down these laws. And so there was a very similar situation to what we may have next year. A progressive Congress, a progressive president, and a very conservative court that just kept striking down, you know, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, a very important New Deal law, the National Industrial Recovery Act, you know, FDR's, you know, main law to challenge the economic problems of the New Deal. So until 1937, the court was striking these down. Then it switched, actually, because FDR threatened to pack the court. And began upholding these laws. Now, conservatives look back nostalgically to this pre-1937 court that was striking down these big laws. They would like to bring that back. And if they get five votes, you know, and it could even have six, to do that, they could begin saying that Congress literally does not have the power to pass some of these big laws, does not have the power to pass the Social Security Act, that the Constitution does not provide for that, doesn't have the power to enact Medicaid, to enact food stamps. And, you know, we're seeing a little taste of it with how close it came when Obamacare was challenged. It was only because Chief Justice Roberts voted with the liberals that that critical statute that so many Americans rely on for the health care was just narrowly upheld by one vote. There may not be five votes to uphold the Affordable Care Act now. And the Democrats have really been making a big issue about that at the hearings, as they should. So, you know, these things are so ingrained in our national psyche now. We're so used to the idea that, of course, you get Social Security. Of course, you get Medicaid if you need it. But the Supreme Court needs to go along with that. And with six conservatives on the court, it's not clear that they will.
We did a show last week about the Affordable Care Act and what would happen if it is repealed. This case will be heard a week after the election. And it's possible that more than 20 million people will lose their health coverage. Many more will be affected because they have pre-existing conditions. And our guest, Trudy Lieberman, said she's been hearing that some are saying if they strike down the ACA, the Democrats would have a clean slate to come up with a new law. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, they would literally, because there wouldn't be a law, so they could start over. But that would be so frightening. First of all, the level of disruption that does to actual living Americans who are dependent on this law for healthcare today. I mean, you know, literally, of course, there are people who have cancer diagnoses, who are in chemotherapy, who this is the way they pay for their chemotherapy and for their much needed medications. To take that away and say, we're going to go back to the drawing board would just be frightening, right? And then also, if the court strikes down one of these laws, you know, who's to say they won't strike down anything the Democrats come up with? So it's just vital that the court not strike down the Affordable Care Act. And that's why, as I say, I'm not a big fan of court expansion in general, but I'd like to see Democrats begin to say things like, you know, this is a law that was passed by Congress, signed by a president. It's overwhelmingly popular with the American public. If the Supreme Court takes it away, we're certainly going to go after the membership of the court by expanding the court. You know, I think, you know, the stakes are just so high on that.
I'm not sure if you can answer this question, Adam, but you have to wonder what the Republican long view is around all of this, because it's not just Democrats that need relief. So many people need relief. And McConnell says, sorry, we're not doing it because we want Barrett confirmed. The ACA does not just give insurance to Democrats. Obviously, Republicans rely on Social Security and Medicare. Why would they go after these very important programs? Even Roe, 75% of the country supports Roe. Many Republicans are pro-choice. We just don't hear from them very often. Why would they go after these programs that Republicans rely on and have the support of such wide majorities?
Well, a couple of thoughts. One is, you know, I mentioned 1937, a very pivotal year in our country changing. Another pivotal year was 1932. And I actually wrote a different book about that called Nothing to Fear, about FDR's first 100 days, which really changed America. And in writing that book, I was really amazed by, before the New Deal, before FDR came in 1933, after being elected in 1932, America really had very few social programs of any kind. When people were poor, they had to go to their families or to their churches or to, you know, if there was a charity in their neighborhood, a soup kitchen, that was America. There were not social programs. There was no social safety net. And there were a lot of Republicans back then that really wanted it and hated the New Deal. There's that strand in Republican philosophy today that still says the New Deal was a mistake. You know, people should be taken care of if they need help by their families and by charities and by religious organizations, not by the government. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, In this book that I just wrote, Supreme Inequality, a lot of it is about how the court has been so hostile to poor people and to working class people. And that's just a very important strand on the right as well. People, there are a lot of people who just don't like poor people, don't like working class people, blame them for their problems, and basically say they need to work harder to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but the government should not rescue them. I agree, though, it's, you know, so many Republican voters, as you say, rely on these programs, but there is a meanness there that's very deeply felt by a lot of them.
Well, let's take a few calls before we go to break. And again, we're speaking today with Adam Cohen, author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Let's hear from Bill in New Mexico. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam. I was going to ask about the possibility of a return to the Lochner era, and that's what you were covering in talking about the 37 revolution, et cetera. And that, I think that's still relevant, but I'd like to preface my question by, you know, the founders had the belief that the judiciary was the least democratic branch. And so, first of all, have progressives put too much faith in the court system since, say, Brown v. Board? And secondly, do you believe that the Republicans, that the hidden agenda, let's say that we're the Republicans, McConnell and company, they're not really Federalists, they're more Lewis Powell Republicans. Is their agenda, A, to bring back substantive due process, bring us back to Lochner, B, end the delegation of rulemaking that's given us the administrative state, and C, are they crazy enough to try to bring back the unitary executive?
Wow. So great question. I have to say it takes me back to law school because this is how law school exams are written. There are like eight really, you know, 8, 10, 15 really important, really complicated, really interesting questions. And then you've got, you know, 15 minutes to answer them. And I have even less. But these are great questions. And I think the caller is exactly right. You know, there was this era in American law called the Lochner era, which was pre-1937, where the court really made itself an ally of the deregulated state, the idea that government shouldn't intrude on, you know, employers and regulate employment and consumer affairs and things. things like that. I do think the court wants to go back to that. Now, the idea of whether liberals have put too much faith in the Supreme Court, you know, we mentioned just glancingly the Warren Court and the court that, you know, was in place when I was thinking about, you know, becoming a lawyer as a child. And that was a progressive court that looked out for poor people, for criminal defendants, that, you know, integrated the schools in the South and did all these things. But the thing is, not only did the conservatives end the Warren Court, and, you know, my book is a lot about that, about how Nixon ended it very quickly after getting elected. He got four appointments to the court in 3 years and expressly said he was going to end the liberal Warren Court, and he did. But the thing that the conservatives did was not only end the liberalism of the Warren Court, but they put in place an activist conservative court. So what we're talking about now isn't like, wouldn't it be nice if the Supreme Court came along and granted, you know, poor people a lot of rights. What we're talking about now is a right-wing majority on the court that for years now has been doing things like striking down almost every campaign finance law. And we finally saw with Citizens United that they created this right of corporations to spend an unlimited amount of money. They said that was their First Amendment right. We see this court, you know, come along and after Congress has passed the Voting Rights Act, you know, back in 1965 and reauthorized it again and again and again, the Supreme Court comes along and strikes out the heart of it and says, you know, the main part of it, the preclearance requirement, is unconstitutional. So I think at this point, there was a time when I think liberals put a lot of faith in the Supreme Court. Now I think a lot of liberals are just saying, we would like at least a neutral court. We now have a court where a conservative majority has been recklessly striking down, you know, liberal things passed by the Congress and signed by the president. And that's what we have to stop. And instead of stopping it now with Amy Coney Barrett and them getting six votes, we're going to see a lot more of that very dangerous right-wing activism on the court.
You also write, Adam, that Republicans have made the court a focus of their politics in a way Democrats have not, and they've come to look on it with a sense of entitlement. As Trump said on behalf of his Republicans in a March 2018 tweet, "We must always hold the Supreme Court!" exclamation point.
Exactly. It really has been a focus. And when you see them speak at these conservative, you know, to conservative groups, they talk endlessly about how we control the court. We have to keep control of the court. And they've also been just much more strategic about it. And, you know, and when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, and, you know, let me say, I think she was an amazing justice and amazing woman. A lot of people talked about how she had an opportunity to step down in the Obama administration when the Democrats controlled the Senate. And people asked her to, because she already was well along in years and not in the greatest of health. She didn't. And but the Republicans tend to do that. So look at Anthony Kennedy stepped down when he was apparently in very good health. He still seems to be doing fine now and was replaced by a much younger justice. If Ginsburg had done that, we could have replaced her with a liberal justice rather than getting Amy Coney Barrett. So Amy Coney Barrett. So I think, you know, it's both that the Republicans are more focused on the court and feel this sense of entitlement to it, but also that they've acted much more strategically in keeping their seats than the Democrats have.
Well, thank you for the call, Bill. Today, we're speaking with Adam Cohen, author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the future of reproductive rights in the United States. If Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, safe abortion care could be weakened or overturned, and this will have devastating consequences for low-income people and people of color. How are reproductive rights advocates preparing? We should also note that so many polls show that the majority of Americans support keeping abortion legal. Today, we are speaking with Adam Cohen, who served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. He's also a former public interest lawyer, and he's out with an important new book, Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Adam, in the book, you write that the Supreme Court has not just become more conservative, it has become more extreme. Can you talk about what stands out for you when you look at the justices that are appointed by Republicans versus the justices that are appointed by Democrats?
Yeah. So, The justices appointed by Republicans have been really at the far extreme of the conservative spectrum. And it takes someone like Amy Coney Barrett. There, 528 has done an analysis just recently showing that even on the very, very conservative Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based in Chicago, where she now serves, she's in a small group at the most conservative end of that. And that's been true of so many of their appointees. I mean, Clarence Thomas is very, very, very conservative, even among conservatives. So is Samuel Alito. Democrats, on the other hand, have appointed much more centrist justices. So Sonia Sotomayor, who is the most liberal member of the court right now, was a prosecutor, right? She's not someone who worked for the ACLU or did capital death penalty work for, anti-death penalty work. She was a prosecutor in New York. Stephen Breyer was my administrative law professor in law school, and he's a very great and learned man, but he was not by any means a far-out liberal. Neither was Elena Kagan. The Democrats have chosen much more centrist people. And in fact, even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who became, the voice of liberals on the court, when she was on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the appeals court she served on before she was nominated to the Supreme Court, she was actually the most centrist of the liberals. So what we get is center-inclined Democrat appointees and far-right conservative appointees, and that definitely shifts things far to the right. And I think we'll see that if Barrett joins the court, because she'll be pulling it far right. And, a justice like Breyer will stand up to that, but he's not pulling it far left.
Why do you think we don't hear more about this in the media? Just listening to the coverage of Amy Coney Barrett and maybe even the other justices under Trump, you often hear conservative versus liberal, as if there's a left version of Clarence Thomas. It just doesn't exist. So why don't we hear more about this in the media?
It's a great question. And, I think a lot of it is that it is kind of inside baseball. It's something lawyers talk about a lot. Like, lawyers know if you go to work for the ACLU, which I did, or if you do desegregation work or death penalty work, you're not very likely to make it to a federal court, much less to the Supreme Court. So lawyers talk about it. But I think it is a bit of a subtle point. And, having also, been a member of the media, I know that the media, when they talk about the court, likes to talk in shorthand, and liberal versus conservative is a very easy story to tell. But you're right, it misses very important subtleties to what's really going on, and does paint things as being much more liberal than they actually are.
Let's hear from a few more callers. Let's go to Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And I am sorry if this question turns into a politicalization of the court, but it has some. I think something needed to do. Excuse me, have a call to be discussed. Can you talk about the process of impeaching a federal court judge?
Impeaching, yeah. It has not happened often, but it's very similar to a presidential impeachment, where the House has the right to impeach, and then there's a trial in the Senate. But the thing is, even though that is on paper, and the paper in this case being the Constitution, quite possible to do, the bar on that would be extremely high. I mean, it's happened a few times, but it tends to happen for things like real criminality. I don't think we're at the point where we would start to impeach justices just for their political views, particularly when you think about the fact that there are a lot of moderate Democrats in both the House and the Senate. So it's definitely a tool. And if we see, if people could prove that Amy Coney Barrett lied at her, confirmation hearings or something, in theory, she could be impeached. But I think the bar on impeachment of a judge or justice is so high that I think much more of the talk these days is around expanding the court, as we've said, and then also another proposal, which is to limit justices to 18-year terms, which would create turnover and would not lock us in. Maybe Amy Barrett Cummings should be with us for 18 years, not for 40 years if she lives to be in her 80s. So impeachment is definitely a possible tool, but I think pragmatically it's going to be things like court expansion or term limits that might really happen.
What would it take to limit terms?
Well, in theory, just a law. It does not require amending the Constitution. So it would just require the House and Senate to pass a law, the president to sign it. One tricky aspect to all of this, though, is that laws in our system get interpreted by the Supreme Court. So the same thing with court expansion. That would really just require a law passed by the House and Senate by simple majorities signed by the president. And it's been done before. The Supreme Court didn't start out with 9 members. It's the number of justices has been changed by Congress repeatedly over the years. But in the end, the Supreme Court would interpret those laws. So we'd have to worry that, you know, a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate might pass a law either with term limits or expanding the court, the Democratic president might sign it. And then the Supreme Court, 6-3, might say, well, actually, you know, the law is unconstitutional. But I think we're going to, if Biden is elected, if the Democrats take the Senate, we're going to hear a lot more about all of this starting in January.
Well, thank you again for the call, Brad. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hi, a couple of questions and comment maybe. I'm not sure at this point whether, I wouldn't exactly say it's the Republicans, but the people behind the Republicans care whether Trump gets reelected or not. If they have control over the Supreme Court, they're going to be able to decide what laws are constitutional and not constitutional. That's going to have a much bigger impact in a sense of, even if the Democrats by chance should win the presidency and have both houses, you pass a law, it's going to come up to the courts. I mean, you can count on the Republicans taking this to litigation, and we'll have 6 people on the Supreme Court are perfectly willing to rule it unconstitutional. That's one thing. I do think at some point, if she's as bad as I think she is after watching the hearings, that the Democrats better be thinking about ways to do something about this. I'm not really interested in packing the court, but if it comes to that, this country is going to be a lot different even from where it is right now, if 6 of those people on the Supreme Court are willing to go along with either the Trump agenda or what the Federalist people want them to go along with. So it just seems to me it's pretty bleak if she gets in. Finally, I want to say one last thing. I watched too much of the hearings, and I cannot believe that she was able to get by basically without answering a single question that was put to her that was had any relevance at all. And I, you know, it's really surprising to watch that. It wasn't even kabuki. I don't know what you would call that. Lastly, I'd say one thing, just this. I thought about this. You know, every Democrat up there should have played as a part of their beginning when they were making an opening statement. They just should have had a video, and they should have played Lindsey Graham making that statement back in, 2017, 2018? Just indicating that, you know, you can hold me to this, that I'm not going to do this. And he did it. So anyway, thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Adam, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I think the caller made some great points there. And about the kabuki theater aspect, I think the reason that was true is that we all knew from the beginning that the Republicans had 53 votes. I think Collins is the only Republican senator who said she won't vote in favor of Barrett right now. So I think everyone knew that McConnell had the votes, so that it made the whole thing really a sham. I think that's right. And the nominee knew she didn't have to answer any questions because no one was actually going to base their vote on what she said. And then on the other point about Republicans knowing the power of the court, I think that's absolutely right. And the nightmare scenarios the caller raised, I think, are absolutely right. And that's why I go back again to 1937. And I think we'll be hearing a lot more about that. Because again, FDR elected overwhelmingly, very heavy Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. The nation, you know, is living through the Great Depression, 25% unemployment. People are struggling to survive. The Democrats passed these very, very popular laws. The Supreme Court strikes them down because it's in the control of conservatives. And FDR really goes to the mat and says, if you keep striking down my laws, I'm going to pack the court. And the court caved. So I think we're going to need to see a lot of intestinal fortitude on the part of Biden if he's elected, and on the Democratic Congress, and saying we will not tolerate you foiling the will of the people and making people's lives worse. We're going to take you on. So I think it's going to get very interesting next year. I think,
Adam, we have a couple of questions from listeners about what people can do. Can you lay out potential scenarios about what the Democrats and what the people can do? Art writes, Danielle says, is writing Romney, Murkowski, and Collins all we can do at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think going after those swing senators is important, but also I honestly don't think that their minds will change, but I definitely worth giving a shot. I do think that, as I say, I think the next episode, the next chapter of this fight will be when Barrett is on the court, because I think she will be trying to really rein in the court and making it clear to them that we, the American people, won't tolerate too much anti-democratic, you know, right-wing, you know, decision-making. So I think we should all be talking about, as I say, things like expanding the court and court term limits. And I'm not even saying that we need to end up there, but I think by getting our senators and representatives to talk about this and to talk about how we're not going to tolerate a right-wing Supreme Court, you know, running over our rights, I think that could have a very useful effect. I think that all the talking we've been doing has made Chief Justice Roberts a little more moderate than he was when he started out on the court. He's voted with the liberals a little bit. I think that we all need to make our voices clear and really follow the court and talk about the court and let them know that, you know, they're being watched.
You write in your book about what happened when the court struck down New Deal programs that helped poor workers. How did the public respond when that happened?
Well, people were very upset. I mean, these were, you know, these were major laws. The National Industrial Recovery Act was the main law that FDR enacted when he came into office. And FDR in, you know, the early 30s was an almost godlike figure. People really, you know, things were so bad and people had such faith in him. And it was very discouraging. It did appear to be class warfare, right? These, you know, wealthy Republicans on the Supreme Court who mirrored the views of, you know, wealthy Republicans in the country club set back then. So people were very unhappy about it. It did become controversial when FDR threatened to pack the court in 37, because that was such an extreme move. But there was, you know, there was sentiment behind it because people really saw the damage the court was doing. So I hope we can recreate that again if this court continues to do bad things, that there'll be that kind of, you know, outspoken, you know, popular opposition, and that we'll all be calling on Biden to really stand up to the court.
You know, the other thing I've been thinking about specifically around health care, people are going to be so outraged if they lose their health care. And I was thinking, what if the Democrats had put in a public option into the bill? And even people who were told by Republicans that this was a horrible bill would feel it personally and realize, actually, this bill is helping me and my loved ones and my community, and we do not want to give this up. So it seems like one strategy would be for the Democrats to write legislation that actually helps the masses. And then if the Supreme Court takes on the case, the masses might take to the streets and say, oh, no, you will not overturn this law.
I think that would be great. I totally support that. I think it's a great idea. But you know, it's tough, right? Because we're so ingrained in our society to believe that what the Supreme Court says is right, is the law, right? So after Bush versus Gore, I mean, a lot of people were outraged that, you know, the court in 2000 actually stopped the counting of votes in Florida, and you know, but we all kind of accepted it. And Al Gore accepted it. And, you know, when the Supreme Court struck down, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the heart of the Voting Rights Act, you know, the Voting Rights Act was really the crown jewel of the civil rights movement. People died for that law. And again, it was reauthorized by huge majorities in Congress, Republicans and Democrats. The reauthorizations were signed by President Reagan and President Bush. So this was something America believed in with all of its heart. The Supreme Court comes along, strikes out the most important part of it. And, you know, arguably we should have been in the streets then too. But I think as the court drifts further to the right, as it does more outrageous things, and, you know, if they were ever to strike down, you know, healthcare, as you say, I think the American people will be much more outspoken, particularly right when it takes away their drugs and their chemotherapy. Absolutely.
Right. I also want to ask you about the role of money in politics. The New Yorker had a good piece that said, yes, abortion is on the line, healthcare is on the line, workers' rights is on the line, but the money is something that we really need to pay close attention to, because how are you going to overturn Citizens United with a 6-3 court? And Sheldon Whitehouse, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, took his entire 30 minutes to provide a tutorial on the dark money forces at work behind Barrett's nomination. He called this the scheme. And I'm reading from Mother Jones right now. Citing the Washington Post, Senator Whitehouse described a $250 million dark money operation designed to capture the courts and push cases to friendly judges in the hopes of favorable rulings. He said, quote, $250 million is a lot of money to spend if you're not getting anything for it. So that raises the question, what are they getting for it? He talked about the Federalist Society. He talked about the Judicial Crisis Network. They have spent millions of dollars cultivating and promoting conservative ideological candidates like Barrett. He also held up an ad that was funded by anonymous money. Can you talk more about just what this says about money and politics? Because this affects all aspects of our lives.
Absolutely right. And Sheldon Whitehouse did an amazing job, as you say, giving a tutorial on dark money, which was, you know, we need to talk more about. That's the fact that so much of the money that is now in the system, including, as you said, the system of getting justices and judges confirmed, is dark money, is anonymous money that's channeled through organizations that don't need to report where it's coming from. So we suddenly see like a $17 million contribution coming in from who knows where to help, you know, I think it was Kavanaugh get confirmed. Who's funding this and why? Well, a lot of it obviously is corporations and wealthy people. And their agenda is widespread. A lot of it is less regulation for corporations. Some of it is, you know, trying to stamp out abortion and affirmative action. But it's amazing the degree to which I think one of the biggest things the right wing wants, and this right wing money wants, is, as you say, more freedom of them to spend their money. And the thing is, if you look back at the last 50 years of the Supreme Court, you know, as my book does, I think the biggest tragedy is what they have done around campaign finance law. Back in 1974, after Watergate, the American public was so outraged about the role of money and corruption in politics that they got Congress to pass actually a very good campaign finance law. The Supreme Court comes along, strikes down important parts of it, and comes up with this crazy equation where they say money equals speech. And the Supreme Court has used that formulation, money is free speech under the First Amendment, to strike down campaign finance law after campaign finance law, until finally in Citizens United, they actually said that corporations have the right to spend unlimited amount of money from their own treasury to win elections. And if you don't think this is having an enormous impact on every law being passed and every aspect of our society, one example I talk about in the book is, you know, when we look at how the federal minimum wage has not been raised since 2009, and it is eaten away by inflation, by these are hardworking Americans who go to work every day and are making, you know, the same amount that they made in 2009. Why is that? Well, the American public, in poll after poll, overwhelmingly support raising the minimum wage so that hardworking people can, you know, get a decent wage. It's the retail industry, it's the fast food industry, it's folks like that that oppose it. They flood Congress with money, and they've been able to stop raises for, you know, over a decade. So that's the impact that money has on actual people's lives. And that's because the Supreme Court has given the green light and said the First Amendment allows people to give and spend as much as they want, really spend as much as they want, to elect candidates. And it's really doing terrible things.
Bernie Sanders just posted a graphic the other day. Minimum wage in 2009, $7.25 an hour. Minimum wage in 2020, $7.25 an hour. The wealth of billionaires in 2009, $1.3 trillion. The wealth of billionaires in 2020, $3.6 trillion. Another argument you make in the book, Adam, is if you look at Supreme Court decisions, so many of them are in line with the massive inequality that we're seeing now in the United States.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's kind of the tragedy of the story because, you know, I've mentioned the Warren Court in the 60s. It was actually helping poor people. It was talking about poor people and working class people in a very respectful way and talking about the challenges they faced. It was striking down, you know, welfare laws. There was one, the man in the house rule. They actually, you know, a majority of states took welfare away from mothers and children if the mother was found to have a boyfriend. The Supreme Court was striking these things down and fighting for poor people. Nixon comes in 1969, gets four appointments to the court, and suddenly the court turns sharply against poor people and begins elevating the rights of corporations, their right to spend money, their right to, you know, not be sued when they're fired, their right to not have class actions brought against them, their right not to have large punitive damages against them. So the court flipped from caring about regular Americans to caring about the people at the top.
Oh, that man in the house story you tell is absolutely incredible. Adam, we're going to definitely have you back after the election to go in more, into more detail in your book, but because of Amy Coney Barrett, we obviously had to really talk about her and what it means. In our remaining minute, I mean, as you write in the book, the court has done so much to further advance the rights of the privileged and corporations, and has done, you know, the rulings have done little to help the poor and the disadvantaged. And the poor are hit the hardest when you look at so many of these cases. What really concerns you the most as we head into a 6-3 court?
One of the things that concerns me the most is something we've mentioned, that how little Americans know about what the court is doing to them. Because as we've said, the court is really behind a lot of the worst things going on in this country. It's really feeding the political process in a way that, you know, makes it slanted towards the rich and powerful. I think people don't even realize that. So they look at Amy Coney Barrett and say, oh, she looks like a nice lady and she's got these nice children. We need to educate the American public about what the court is doing to the poor and the working class, and we need to fight back.
Mm. Well, Adam, it's such an important book. And like I said, we would love to have you back to go into more detail about the Warren Court. You have so much interesting information about how the court has affected criminal defendants. We talked a little bit about the poor, but also job discrimination, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, for example, and Lilly Ledbetter herself and what happened to her, and then how the court has really ruled in favor of those at the top and corporations. So thank you so much for this book, and we would love to have you back after the election.
I would love to be back. It was a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Adam Cohen served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. He is a former public interest lawyer and author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. And you can find more information about Adam's work at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, in related news, we will talk about the future of abortion rights. If Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to the Supreme Court, safe abortion care could be weakened or overturned. And this will have devastating consequences for low-income people and people of color. Polls continue to show that the majority of Americans support keeping abortion legal. So how are reproductive rights advocates preparing? That is tomorrow. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find our past shows and all of our election coverage at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.